So I'm going to go backwards now. I'm not going to tell you my story, how I became more religious. The truth is I came from a traditional family, meaning we had Shabbat Kiddush. Most of the holidays were things that were observed in some fashion or another. There was kashrut in the home. So the story was not as dramatic, and the leap of faith in university, my university years, was not such a giant leap of faith. I didn't have to go to the Himalayas. I didn't have to have God speaking to me in a dream. Right? So there are more interesting stories you can read about. But I will tell you that when I came to yeshiva, there was a certain atmosphere there. This is in the early 80s. This is sort of the beginning of the movement, not the first generation, probably the second. But there was an excitement going on there that I think existed from the inception of the movement, which we can place perhaps a little after the Six-Day War. In any case, in my time period, there was one Rosh Yeshiva who would gleefully yell out in different occasions, "It's a revolution." And that's where the title comes from. It's a revolution. And I think for us, who were not too, who came to the movement not too long after the 60s, that was extremely appealing. We still look up to the rebels and revolutionaries of the 60s who believed in social justice, in world peace, that better times were around the corner, and that we as activists could have a major role in bringing about those better times. And granted, that may not have been the most important component in our coming back to Judaism. I think we would be what Fernak Margulies in her book Off the Derech calls truth seekers. I think most of us were interested in understanding life, understanding God, understanding our place in the world on as much as we could, an intellectually honest approach to truth. And certainly the warm Shabbos meals and the singing, the kumzitz has also had its role. But one should not underestimate the appeal of the notion of social revolution, that we were being called upon to bring back, to be part of this movement that would bring back the masses, the majority of the Jewish people, back to Jewish tradition. And through that, changing the world as a whole, bringing the Jewish people back to taking their vanguard role in world morality. And this, I think, was the dream that was put in front of us, and a dream that many of us accepted and believed in. We understood that we would go back to our friends, our families, our colleagues in the Jewish world, be they Reform, conservative, or secular Jews. And speaking their language, we would be able to take on, pass on this exciting message of a relevant and interesting Judaism. And as the title indicates, somehow that dream never took place. The revolution the Rosh Yeshiva spoke about simply wasn't. It's true that on a technical level, many Balei Tshuva were sent back to become outreach workers, outreach professionals. I love that term, outreach professionals. It is even an organization, the Association of Jewish Outreach Professionals. I don't know if it's unionized, but you know, we have status. So we were sent out, many of us were sent out, to be foot soldiers in this revolution. But it became clear to some of us, those that were perhaps thinking on a deeper level or had greater ambitions, that the role of the Baal Tshuva was really quite limited. To put it succinctly, what the Baal Tshuva was expected to do in this project was to translate, not to create. To translate the teachings that we got from the establishment, from the religious establishment, which perhaps was broader than a traditional yeshivot. But as far as inputting and creating and bringing a new vision to Judaism. The outsider's vision and version, if you will. In the same way as Moshe Rabbeinu brought his personality from the outside, that was simply lacking. Of course, I'm not speaking about expecting a Baal Tshuva who's in the yeshiva for 2 months to come up with a new treatise on Judaism, which some have, and obviously is not something that's worth very much. I'm reminded of the story about the Musar Yeshiva, where a novice comes in and sees everybody involved in their Musar study, and it appears to them to be very easy, because all they're all saying the same thing. They're all saying that I'm a nothing. They're in their rows, everybody's saying, I'm a nothing. Student is a novice, he's afraid, he doesn't want to do something that's not appropriate, but he sees that's all they're doing. So he takes a seat in the back row, and first quietly starts saying, I'm a nothing, but he sees everybody's in a crescendo, so he starts getting bold and encouraged. And he gets into it, and he starts, I'm a nothing, and soon enough he's yelling even louder than everybody else. So the guys in front of him say, who does he think he is being a nothing? He just got here. So you can't expect, and nor am I calling for, a new Baal Tshuva to be respected as a major voice in Judaism if he knows nothing. That's no different than anyone else. The fact that he's an outsider doesn't give him the extra right to speak from ignorance. That's not what I'm speaking about. But in fact, there have been people who have come from a Baal Tshuva background, who have been kept back by it. Great people, such as Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, who is a Baal Tshuva, and who has been criticized for his lack, quote, of Masorah, that he doesn't have a tradition. And for some, that is a reason not to accept his teachings. Someone much more subtle, much more part of the Haredi world, Rabbi Shlomo Volba, had the privilege of meeting the great Musar teacher, who also had his own approach to things and was privately critical of mainstream ultra-Orthodox community to which he belonged. And I was not surprised to read in one book by an important rabbi who had to point out that Rav Volba didn't have the right to a certain opinion because, after all, he himself didn't come from tradition. So these sort of things, which are perhaps blatant in those two examples that I gave, are things that you find certainly in the ultra-Orthodox world, but even in the modern Orthodox world. I believe that a person's background as a Baal Tshuva is not held as something positive, but rather cause for suspicion and question whether, in fact, there's authenticity to new approaches that they might bring forward. And it's true that the center of the Baal Tshuva world is, in fact, in the Lithuanian yeshivot, the world of the Lithuanian yeshivot, which is part of the Haredi world, and that creativity and deviation are certainly not things that are encouraged in general. However, the leeway given to a Rav Dessler, who is not a Baal Tshuva, is not the same leeway that's given, in my humble opinion, to a Baal Tshuva. Unless we think that I'm making an outlandish suggestion that we should allow Baalei Tshuva, not just allow, but encourage Baalei Tshuva to be more creative and to present their own vision of traditional Judaism, the example of Moshe Rabbeinu that I gave before is not the only example in our history. All of the Imahot, all of our mothers, came from corrupt backgrounds in terms of their families, right? Whether it's Sarah, whether it's Rivka, whether it's Rachel and Leah, all of them are coming from families that we wouldn't describe as Hamish. And if we want to go further in Jewish history, possibly the two greatest sages of the Talmudic period also are coming from the outside. Rabbi Eliezer Hagadol, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, and Rabbi Akiva are both, for all intents and purposes, Baalei Tshuva. And who can doubt the important influence of Rabbi Akiva on Jewish learning? And Rabbi Eliezer, who was his teacher, also someone of tremendous impact on Jewish thought. Of course, you can say, ancient precedents aside, there are some risks that would be brought forth by allowing too much leeway, and certainly by encouraging Baalei Tshuva to create. And I think the leaders of the movement were aware of that, and perhaps that is why they wanted to keep their charges at bay. And I don't want to underestimate the issues. Social engineering is not a simple thing. And creating a movement of people who are going to divorce themselves from their upbringing is certainly not an easy thing to do and comes with fallout. There were fears that people were going to be involved in work with Baalei Tshuva. People who didn't come from that community would be risking their own spiritual lives by exposure to things that were threatening on a spiritual level. There was concern about the bad influences that Baalei Tshuva would bring themselves, their lack of refinement in speech and action. And the influences they would bring by continued connection with their families and friends, which would be a channel through which they would have exposure to the general Orthodox community as well. Stability, emotional stability, was also an issue that needed to be examined. Would Baalei Tshuva, after getting married and having children, entering into midlife crisis, would they choose too easily the course which many of their own parents had taken, simply divorce and strand and desert their families? And as I said before, I don't want to minimize these issues because to some extent all of these have had an impact. But the question is, to what extent do we shut off any risk and danger at the cost of the benefits that may come out of allowing and encouraging Baalei Tshuva to develop in their own ways? Before expanding on that, just want to give you some things that I saw over the internet in sites that cater to Baalei Tshuva. I saw some rabbis saying things to my mind which are simply unacceptable. One rabbi saying as follows, that I would venture to say that like Baalei Tshuva, most FFBs, from birth people, also don't have a Rav to guide them. He was saying it's true, most people don't have a Rav. However, he says that in the case of the Baalei Tshuva, that's unacceptable. As he says as follows, that Baalei Tshuva are in much greater need of someone to tell them how to really live their lives. Since Baalei Tshuva don't have that from parental and grandparental wisdom to rely on. So anyone who's a Baal Tshuva does not have wise parents and does not have wise grandparents. It's simply something that is axiomatic, according to this rabbi. There's something much worse, and I think both of these are serious rabbis. I don't think that I just found something of wacky guys that just shooting off the cuff. The other rabbi says something which I found even more problematic. He warns Baalei Tshuva about the likelihood they will experience spiritual vertigo. I don't know if all of you know what vertigo is, but essentially when you're flying and you lose sense of which way is up and which way is down. So he says that for Baalei Tshuva, you can have spiritual vertigo. I think the metaphor is particularly unfortunate. He says that the spiritual vertigo will prevent the Baalei Tshuva from knowing whether they are up and down or down. And so he tells them that the conclusion is not to trust their own judgment. Those are his words. Don't trust your own judgment if you're a Baal Teshuva. I think this type of approach to the Baal Teshuva is simply untenable. Granted, there are some who enter the movement with emotional issues, but I would grant, and I certainly hope, that that's not the mainstay of the movement. And if it is, then we have perhaps even a greater problem. I think what is needed, what is appropriate, is to develop a person, to help a person develop in the same way as a child would develop, to the point of self-sustenance, where they can stand on their own two feet, and certainly not to suggest that they're doomed to a fate of spiritual vertigo, where they can't trust their judgment, and they have to seek out the wisdom of a Rav, who will be a replacement, a surrogate for their parents. I mentioned earlier, at the beginning of my talk, that I've had the fortune to be a teacher to many Baalei Teshuva. And quite often I would hear from them, generally not in the institution that I teach in, which is perhaps more open-minded and has a greater respect for the student, but it would happen that some teachers in that institution also would tell their students things, perhaps most commonly literal acceptance of midrashim and stories, that the Baalei Teshuva would simply repeat and accept things that really stretched their credibility to the point that were they ever to present some of these ideas to people back home, they would be sent away to mental institutions. The point here is that the rabbis were not concerned about respecting the worldview that the Baal Teshuva came in with. And granted, the Baal Teshuva is at least as equally culpable in this, that no one asked them to check their brains in when they came through the door. When I heard the students telling me such things, I would tell them that if anything forces you to twist yourself into a pretzel, for goodness sake, question it. Find out if it's the only view in the religious world. And consider whether you can really respect yourself for accepting what you heard from your rabbi. In fact, in many cases, they did not do that and ended up simply losing any self-confidence that they have, not trusting their own judgment. And it's no wonder that what the rabbis speak about spiritual vertigo and not having wise parents would find a receptive audience. However, sometimes I was successful in bringing over what I believe to be a more mature approach to learning Torah thought, which is not always in consonant with the Western intellectual upbringing that such students would have. And though I have my issues with Western thought, it's a worldview that needs to be taken seriously, and certainly by those of us who have been raised in it. So one of my students wrote back after a weekend event, Shabbat event, the following, having come to appreciate the type of approach that I was suggesting. She says as follows, she wrote as follows. I've been learning to be confident with my decisions, that Judaism endows man with the strength to use his mind, instead of looking for a shortcut to the truth, which is what I had been doing until I came in contact with this approach. I have to trust myself and maybe take the longer route or the one less traveled on. I have to be intellectually honest. What does that mean to me? It means to be real about life. instead of just swallowing what's being taught, it means asking questions. It means challenging foundations and hypotheses. It means being okay with the discomfort of not having all the answers. I think that's a mature approach to Torah for anyone. And certainly for someone who has a different approach in their upbringing. To throw it all out is simply inappropriate. And I think that Baalei Tshuva need to realize that veteran religious Jews, be they rabbis or lay people, don't always have all the answers. And they should question whether what they're saying and how they're acting is not simply a product of imitating that which is simply done. Not that which is necessarily the value that Judaism tries to put forward. And I think this approach from the Baalei Tshuva is not only a service to him or herself, but it's a service to the Jewish community, as I mentioned before. We need that outsider's vision. We need those people that were raised in the court of Paro to stand up and question. And simply to dismiss their questions by saying that they're Baalei Tshuva and therefore they don't know what they're talking about is not an intellectually honest answer. On some level, I think that God is manipulating history in a time where we need an outsider's approach. And instead of appreciating that which is being given to us, we're pushing it away. So getting back to my question, whether we are a success story, those of us who maintained our own vision in the face of the normative Orthodox community, I would tell you that many of us ended up having to find our own way. For some, that meant going bitterly back to their former lives, rejecting that which they had learned in the Baal Tshuva institutions. Others went into Jewish studies departments at universities where they could feel more at ease with the type of discourse at a great loss to the Jewish community, which has very little to do with these departments, and there's good reason. Because ultimately, academic study is very much divorced from practice and life. So we've lost those. And the remainder of us have been dispersed to the four corners of the earth, different yeshivot, mostly mainstream yeshivot, be they Zionist, be they Haredi, be they Hasidic. Hardly a movement in terms of the intellectual currents that we could bring forth to the Jewish community. My own case, the small following that I do have, I rarely count Baalei Tshuva. Because I'm saying things that are too much out of the mainstream. I want to share a conversation I had at one point when I was fundraising for this vision, and I came to a very successful Baal Tshuva. And we had a nice conversation, and he seemed to be agreeing with everything that I was saying. Then he asked a question which I knew I wouldn't be able to answer to his satisfaction. He said to me, "So, this is great. Who is your Das Torah?" Meaning, I agree with everything you say, but I don't trust you. In fact, I don't trust myself. So therefore, I really can't ascribe to your vision without knowing that it has a stamp of kashrut. That's in fact kosher. Needless to say, I didn't get the donation. I mentioned earlier that I have great respect for what the Baal Tshuva movement has done, and I don't mean to take away from that. As someone who has studied and is interested in history, however, I look at the larger picture and question whether the opportunity that the Baal Tshuva movement presents is being squandered in historical terms. To put it into more colloquial terms, I'm glad I'm in North America where you understand baseball, because I can put it in those terms. I had to translate this in South Africa to soccer. It didn't go as well. But in baseball, if you're losing by 3 points, and you step up to the plate, there's no one on base, it's the end of the game, and you hit a home run, it's very nice, but you still lose the game. And I'm wondering, at our stage in history, I think we tend to paint it much more sugar-coated than it is. I think the danger to tradition in general, and Jewish tradition in particular, is much greater than we realize. And I don't know if we're at the bottom of the ninth inning, but certainly it's not clear to me that the home run, which is the Baal Tshuva movement, is enough to win the game. And if it's not, then it really is a squandered opportunity. Before I take questions, I just want to conclude by saying, letting the movement do what I believe it could have done, the revolution that could have been, does involve taking tremendous risks, opening ourselves up to new voices with completely new twists on what the tradition is supposed to mean is dangerous. And I'm not coming to deny that. But not doing anything is also coming with great risks. When the rabbis say, Shev ve'al ta'aseh adif, in a situation of doubt, it's better to be passive. But there's more danger to activity than passivity. That wasn't meant to be a credo. That wasn't meant to be a general statement for any and every doubt that we have. Rather, in a very limited case, when the doubt is impossible, to determine what is more probable, then the rabbis say, in fact, it's better to be passive. In our case, I believe we're not in that situation. And so I believe that not taking risks in our time may be the biggest risk of all. I'm very concerned that at the end of the game, home run or not, we'll end up having lost. Thank you. A few minutes left for questions. Yeah, go ahead. There's apparently a microphone there, so I think they want you to speak up to the microphone. Right?
Working?
Push it down.
Okay. Hello. Could you please outline briefly what you see as the biggest differences between the modern Orthodox and the Haredi movement, and why the Haredi movement came about and attracts many Baal Tshuvas as opposed to the modern Orthodox movement?
Right. Okay, excellent question. The first part I'm going to skip because it would take the whole day. The difference between modern Orthodoxy and the Haredi approach. It's actually what you ask about why is the Haredi world more attractive to the Baal Tshuva than the modern Orthodox world, I think is actually touches on my next talk. I don't want to give it away completely. But I think that there is a behavioral intensity that exists in the Haredi world that is lacking in the modern Orthodox world, meaning that the Baal Tshuva is looking for something that's a complete experience, where the involvement with Judaism is much more emotional, is much more time-consuming. I think that has appeal for someone who's certainly a truth seeker, who is dissatisfied with the Western world that he lives in. And modern Orthodoxy is a bridge-making type of operation, which tries to get the best of both worlds so that it has a greater value, if you will, for the Western world, which also means less time and less intensity for the Jewish experience. It's on one foot. It's interesting, I remember hearing, I think I wrote it at some point, yeah. It was one of my talks about this topic, that encountering someone feeling bad that they had been drawn to the Haredi world as a Baal Tshuva, not a more modern approach. I think there are many Baal Tshuva that actually go through this and feel less connected later on in life. I remember doing the Slifkin affair. I don't know if everyone's familiar with the Slifkin affair, but where the Haredi world came out very strongly against Rabbi Natan Slifkin for taking positions that had been held by many other people, suggesting that the rabbis could be wrong on scientific issues, meaning the rabbis in the Talmud, making other similar positions and speaking about the world being created in more than 7 days, which again was not unique to him, but he was given a real beating by the Haredi world, so that the rabbis, the Haredi rabbis in Israel, almost unanimously, I mean just about unanimously, came out very strongly against him in writing, and whatever American rabbis disagreed either gave in or simply kept a low profile, so that Rabbi Slifkin was essentially left to defend himself in the Haredi world. I remember having an exchange of emails at the time with a Baal Tshuva doctor who had become part of the Haredi world, as many had done. And I asked him, you know, if the Haredi world is taking this position, where does that leave you? And he said that he wasn't prepared for sociological reasons to leave the Haredi world, which I think is very true factor for many people, be they Baal Tshuva or otherwise. It's something that I think the modern Orthodox world has to appreciate more, that they're losing so many for sociological reasons. In any case, this fellow said that he realizes that intellectually he's modern Orthodox. So that the initial attraction is not necessarily something that stays with the Baal Tshuva. But nonetheless, as with this fellow, I think that the die is already out, in the sense that this is the community that they're going to raise their children in. So whatever reservations they might have later on in life, that they've essentially integrated into a worldview that is not necessarily a worldview that appreciates their approach to life. Yeah, back there.
The kind of questions that you're saying are important for Baal Tshuvas to be able to express and that are valuable, do you find that the rabbis of the Talmud, that their questions and that makes up so much part of the Talmud, are the kind of questions that you're talking about of substance and of almost like a freedom the ability to question? And if you don't think they are of that type, where are the questions lacking in the Talmud that you think the Baal Tshuva has to offer? And also, because when the Baal Tshuva comes to the traditional world, this is my second question, what do you think would give us the strength to be able to hold on to some of that outsider's approach, to be able to, you know, make it a a component that integrates in the right balance, what gives them the would give them the strength if we're sort of outnumbered? And also, number three, where do you see the home run being hit? What do you think would have to take place for you to say, in some goals, like, yeah, we're hitting a home run?
Yeah, I'm looking for the grand slam, not the home run. But okay, there you go. Okay, so again, I'm not going to have time to answer most of what you're raising, but I'm going to pick on a couple things. Number one, in terms of the questions that are being asked by various Talmudic figures, it's actually fascinating that one of the two that I mentioned, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, was known for perhaps the Baal Tshuva approach that I'm critiquing. He was known for saying that he never said anything that he didn't hear from his own teacher. So that's actually fascinating. But I think you, those of you in the know, realize that Rabbi Eliezer's was in competition with Rabbi Yeshua. There was very much a real war, a Torah war that was a famous story of the Tanur Shalachnai, where Rabbi Yeshua famously got up against Rabbi Eliezer and said, You can't bring proofs from the sky that lo b'shamayim hi, that the Torah is on earth. And among other things, this is a longer Torah, but among other things, Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer were competing for the great student Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, the Gemara tells us, was a student of both, but ultimately went to the side of Rabbi Yeshua, which is a more expansive approach. And I think Rabbi Akiva's originality is clearly a product of coming from a different existence. I think that it's impossible for a human being not to bring their existence into the way they look at a tradition, into a document. One thing that I've noticed as a parshan, as an interpreter of Torah, is to what extent a person's personality is revealed through how they understand the word, how they understand the text. Just one quick example, and Siv was a great lover of people, and that love expresses itself in his parshanut. So I think that willy-nilly, the Baal Tshuva is going to come with a different type of question sometimes, and with a different type of answer sometimes. Okay, there are other questions. There were good questions in terms of what is the Grand Slam. So I'm waiting for the Rev Steinsaltz Unfettered. I'm not speaking about Rev Steinsaltz in particular, but I'm saying that were we to encourage Baalei Tshuva to develop their thought, then we could have one or more truly outstanding religious thinkers that may be able to give the Torah that we need. I think the leader that I think of is Rav Kook, who in his time, I think, that wasn't universally accepted, brought a Torah, brought a creativity to the world which really answered and really dealt with the zeitgeist, really dealt with the challenges that were affecting Torah and tradition. And I'm looking for that. That's Rav Kook to me was a grand slam. I'm looking for that grand slam, and I think that the grand slam doesn't have to come from the Baal Tshuva community. And we'll take it from wherever we get it, but certainly that's a fertile ground for that grand slam.